So I'm interested in speaking with you about whatever it is that's of most importance for you today. And so I want to spend a minimal amount of time showing you bits of my PowerPoint presentation that I used yesterday and that's now soon to be available on the web. But the whole point I see is to invite questions about what is it that modern science of mind and brain, primarily from Western traditions, though now being pursued globally, has to learn from spiritual traditions that involve one or another kind of contemplative practice, like meditation or prayer, and to then even invite further possibilities about collaborative mixing of these different approaches to investigating and appreciating our lived experience. So I do have this PowerPoint slide show, and we'll see if that adds anything. Of course, the remote's probably not going to work. Looks like it's been left in the on position. It wouldn't surprise me if a battery is what would be most helpful in this circumstance, though. Oh, now it's working. Yeah. I grew up in Northern California and was fortunate enough to spend time at both the ocean and the mountains, the Sierra Nevadas in particular. And I've always felt my spirit most elevated at higher geographic elevations. So I'm quite pleased to be living in Colorado at 5,000 feet right next to mountains such as this that go up to 14,000 feet. And I mentioned that by way of noting, at least anecdotally, a connection between where we live and how we live and our experience of our environment mixing with our experience of our interior. And indeed, from perhaps some Buddhist and other perspectives, the traditional Western distinction of separating outer and inner itself can be called into question conceptually and even experienced as infirm, as not there, as dissolved. These are the things I spoke of yesterday. Two topics. One, a rapid fire introduction to cognitive neuroscience, something about how brain cells communicate with each other in complex networks, and also touching on the sometimes profound experiences people have as part of their own path of contemplative development. Then, in bringing those together, I sought to address the question of what can cognitive neuroscience learn from contemplative spirituality, and taking it to at least two levels, one being the objectification of spiritual experience. Science is good at that, and I'm quite interested in what we can learn from taking a scientific look at contemplative spirituality. But not leaving it there, that if it's a contemplative institution hosting a contemplative group of researchers who meditate together or take a contemplative approach to conducting their research and really make contact with the people they're studying, then to what extent might psychological science grow to become itself something of a contemplative mode of inquiry? We're quite interested at Naropa University in exploring those possibilities. So, cognitive psychology for years has taken an information processing approach to understanding mental function. And I should say at the outset that as a third generation scientist in my family, my understanding of science is not one of absolute dominion over truth, but rather science is an evolving body of knowledge that is always incomplete and inaccurate, and we don't even know which bits are inaccurate. That's what we'll learn in the future. Nonetheless, I see great vibrancy and potency in the field of scientific exploration as one excellent means for coming to know more about the universe we live in, about making greater contact with at least some aspects of mystery. Indeed, if you picture the entire corpus of scientific knowledge as a bubble, over time, each day, each year, it does grow larger. But what that means is the surface area, the contact with the unknown, is also increasing. One answer to a question leads to a set of additional questions beyond that bit of knowledge that we didn't even know to ask before. So as scientific knowledge expands, we're actually in greater contact with the unknown, with mystery. And, you know, maybe not all of the great mystery is accessible to science. I have no idea. Certainly not in this day. We're nowhere close. But as a project of human inquiry, science, I believe, has the potential to serve higher needs of humanity and not only be a begetter of technological innovation that puts us in peril and that jeopardizes the humanity of our situation on planet Earth. So as a scientist, I'm happy to be working in an area that seems to have greater prospect for beneficial application than harmful application. When I was in doctoral training, I spoke with my advisor, who's a very sweet man, very warm-hearted individual, and I said, you know, I don't want to be working on areas that have harmful applications. I don't want to work on doing basic research, understanding aspects of the mind and brain that have beneficial applications. And he sat me down. He said, look, there's no way to know for sure. When you do basic research, it goes out there and then various people will do various things with it. And I really appreciated that honesty. I mean, it sort of deflated me in the moment. It's like, oh, darn. But it made me feel a need to take responsibility for what I do research on and how I do it and what is my intention. So this is a lively topic in our teaching of research students at Naropa for us to reflect together and individually on what it is we're doing and what are the possible ramifications. So as a topic, meditation and contemplative spirituality lends itself, I believe, to more positive application. That's my aspiration. In fact, we have a motto of our laboratory: may we be of benefit through this research. I'm kind of rambling on different points here, but I'm also trying to say some things that had not been mentioned yesterday. So cognitive psychology, cognitive neuroscience, takes a look at many different topics, now including consciousness, especially in the last decade or two, and now moving also into spiritual experience. Why not? From my point of view, anything that occurs within human experience presents itself as a possible topic for scientific research in the field of psychology. So far, so good?
Yes.
Okay. So, yesterday I did go over what a brain cell does. It's perfectly geared for communicating with other brain cells. Just like muscles are geared for extension or contraction and motion of body parts, bone cells are structured to be firm and solid and serve as mechanical support. Brain cells are all about communication. That's what they do. And indeed, different parts of the brain, as we'll see, activity therein corresponds to different content of conscious experience. Strong evidence comes from that, for example, if your visual cortex is compromised physiologically due to a stroke or head injury, you may no longer have visual experience. Though your eyes work fine, you become cortically blind. And indeed, you not only thereafter no longer enjoy visual experience of perception, you are no longer able to call to mind visual images from memory. So the evidence is very strong in support of the understanding that at least many parts of our experience depend on intact brain cells communicating in the proper way. So here's how a neuron works. It has a cell body with a long axon to send signals to other cells. And indeed, it connects with 1,000 or 10,000 other neurons. Likewise, it has many, I've just shown three dendrites coming into the cell body that carry signals in from their synaptic connections with other neurons. So I've just used all the jargon that I hope to use in this talk with regard to brain science. Let's see how it works. If one signal comes in, that may not be enough to get it to fire. But if two signals come in at once, then it's enough to send a signal on to the next neuron. So there's a computation, a processing of information that a single brain cell does to see whether there's enough news coming in from other neurons to send it out. And it's not always just one or two, but in this simplified diagram, that's how I'm showing it to you. Is that a helpful concept? Yes. So, I don't know exactly what it's like to be this cell. I'm not a single cellular being. I'm a multicellular being. I only know what it's like to be this composite of all these cells, including a living nervous system that suffuses my body with sensitivity, and including the spinal cord and the brain. So, if light strikes the eye, there are photoreceptors in the retina that transduce light energy into neural signals. And so rather than having dendrites, the photoreceptor is a specialized neuron that does have a cell body, and once enough light comes in, then it sends a signal. And that signal connects with another neuron. And that neuron that receives that information then sends signals on to the neuron to which it's connected. So though these neurons don't move about, they're static in the tissue, some of the time they're sending signals and some of the time they're not. And so it's informative when signals come or when signals don't come, either way. So if we look at a few of these together, we'll see that I've colored them differently just so you can see them. Here's a cell body, here's some dendrites, and so from time to time it gets information from various other neurons. And when the information comes in enough together, then it will signal to the neuron to which it's connected. So, does that help?
Well, I guess the way I want to imagine is that you probably measure, like you must be measuring that there's more than one signal coming in. How do you even know that's happening? And I have to say that people around me don't know this about me, but I have a background in applied experimental design. So when you put those charts up yesterday, I was like, cool charts. So I have all these dorky questions that maybe we don't want to take all this time on. I just, when you said that yesterday, I was a little bit curious, like, how do you know, I'm trying to remember from my training a long time ago, like, how do you even know that's what's happening, and what's the point at which something actually happens? In other words, how much information is sort of roaming around in here before there's a response?
Great question. I think that comment reveals the nuance and rich complexity of this system, because we've been talking about the function of a single brain cell or neuron and how some of the input signals to it don't cause it to depolarize and send a voltage difference signal out along the cable that is its output, the axon, and rather it's just sort of this murmuring, this mumbling inside the brain system that doesn't yet go beyond that neuron. And so all of the activity, all of the communication that does happen between the brain cells is a selective reduction of the total set of signals that are happening in the brain, because each neuron provides a gating function where it gets some inputs and doesn't do much with them. And then other inputs come synchronously in a timing that is enough to depolarize the cell, and it's this electrochemical effect. So perhaps we could discuss that further, because it's starting to seem a bit heavy on the neuroscience side. But suffice it to say that what I am describing today is a simplification. There's the Annual Society for Neuroscience meets with many tens of thousands of neuroscientists from all over the world coming together. It's a very large meeting. Now, of course, just over a year ago, His Holiness the Dalai Lama addressed that group of scientists as their keynote speaker, because there's a recognition in the field that there is more than has been studied thus far in the laboratory. So it's a very exciting time for these fields to be in communication with each other. So if we zoom out, this is one little circuit, say, of these neurons that are connected with each other. There are actually many such circuits in the brain, and they're not just sitting there quietly. They're all percolating on the inputs that they have been receiving, communicating with each other, and sending their outputs. So there are some networks, like in visual cortex, for example, that are active when we're having visual experience, whether perception or imagery, memory, dreams, hallucinations. Likewise, there are other circuits involved in the experience of sound, bodily feeling, and even plans for the future and experiences of emotion, such as fear. So I at least wanted to get to this point in the presentation so that we'd have a visual to relate to in terms of the degree to which some parts of human experience have been found to be anatomically localized to some degree, where activity in that part of the brain is involved in that part of experience, and that when that part of the brain dies or goes away or becomes inactivated, then that experience is also disrupted. So I have, in my slideshow, gone on to talk about other things, such as some of the nature of spiritual experience. I feel very daring when I do that, to try and put that into words, but nonetheless, I play that game. And then going on to talk about some physiological data and anatomical data that researchers have generated in the last couple of years that show very potent effects of meditation on our brain systems. Due to limited time...
Well, I think it would be great if we advanced at least to that research. You know, I think that this is sort of a hardcore group that is pretty experienced with different paths of spirituality, and we'd love to see those two items that you brought, because they're really quite fascinating.
Very good. We may want to sit through this animation simply by virtue of the slideshow, but I'll mention that attention operates through a network of different neural circuits that influences the degree to which certain content of experience are attentionally focused on and brought or emphasized into awareness. And attention, you should know, is a topic of laboratory research that for 4 decades has been investigated quantitatively. So you might be surprised to think that something as central to your own lived experience and mental function as selective attention and integrative attention and sustaining attention, these different functions, have actually been scrutinized in psychological laboratories And as processes have been illuminated to a significant degree, and I have contributed to some of that work in a small part myself. So one take home of that is we have all of this stuff happening in our head, and on the, from the inside, that first person perspective, often it feels disorienting, confusing, a lot going on, maybe too much going on sometimes. And yet at other times, there's a sense of clarity, a sense of spaciousness, peace, whatever it is, even though some thoughts may still be arising in our experience. And so this observable difference that may be cultivated through contemplative practice prompts me, as a psychological scientist, to ask further questions of attention, ask further questions of brain function, to better understand from a scientific perspective how it is we are capable of quieting the mind, of making contact and connecting with that which is greater than ourselves. So I talked about my own experience with meditation as a Buddhist. I practice in the Vajrayana Shambhala Buddhist tradition, a Tibetan-American Buddhism that I started in 1981 as a practitioner, as a student. And in the Rocky Mountains, there's this lovely stupa of Dharmakaya, which is a reliquary and homage to the teachings and life of Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, who, among other things, founded Naropa University in 1974. And so by contemplative, I mean noticing what's happening in our experience. And any practice or lifestyle that holds that as a value and where that leads. I adopt the phrase open awareness to remind us that we can experience the combination of being relaxed while awake, and that may involve a degree of invitation or opening. And indeed, for a lot of people who engage in any form of contemplative spirituality, that seems to be at least part of what's there for them, what's here for us. I appreciate the English translation of the term bodhicitta as reminding us that awakened heart is not separate from mind, and that heart-mind is the way I prefer to think about mind. So when I say mind, I have a rather inclusive, expansive scope of referent for that term. I don't mean just our little chatterbox or only conceptual mind, but all that is in our experience and that underlies our experience. Yesterday, the topic came up of to what extent is any of us in control of anything, or let alone our experience. And we recognize that there's really much we can do to open up a space and cultivate and invite and then see what happens, which reveals, I feel, a very important strand of empiricism in contemplative spirituality, where we actually want to see what happens. We want to take notice. We want to observe our experience and appreciate it. So I led a brief meditation yesterday for about 10 minutes and then spoke to looking at what happens when, on the one hand, we may have this dizzying array of activations in our brain, or we might have experience that feels a little bit more peaceful, and yet there's still brain activity. And there is some evidence now pointing to the difference being, among other things, a more harmonious working together of different parts of the brain. Physically, that they're in greater temporal coherence with each other. So my understanding is that when awareness clears or our horizon expands in our experience, that there is some distance that neuroscience could go in accounting for some of that experience by having a greater panoramic vista of the various activities in different parts of the brain, many of which we still have no idea what they are about, entering into collaborative interaction in our lived experience. Here's some data that I shared yesterday where the scale on the x-axis horizontally is seconds, looking at 2.5 minutes, 3 minutes, and the vertical axis is the percent coherence between the left and the right hemispheres in electrical activity of the brain in the frequency range 25 to 42 cycles per second. This is a set of 8 subjects averaged together across people in 4 different blocks. So each colored line is 1 block. It's not an individual person. And you can see I feel much more secure now that
they're right there to help us.
Okay. It's fine if they listen in, but all right. Okay. Thank you. So there's 45 seconds or so of resting where the participants are not instructed to be meditating. And then meditation begins, and there is a very clear difference. I always like seeing the actual biological tracing of the data through time because you can see the variability. But there is a clear increase in the coherence of activity being in sync between the left and the right sides of the head with meditation compared to the same individuals when not meditating. And this is in a loving kindness, metta meditation. The 8 participants whose data we see here were also compared to 10 control subjects who were not meditators. And though I'm not showing those data here, there was a significant difference in the resting state with the meditators having greater coherence between activity of neurons in the left and right cortical hemispheres compared to the non-meditating control subjects. So there are both lasting cumulative effects on individuals who engage in prolonged periods of contemplative practice over extensive periods of time compared to people who do not. And even within those individuals, there's also a difference of what's happening in their brain anyway between when they're not intentionally meditating and when they are. So this is one of the 2 data slides that it is important for you to see. And before I push on, if there are questions about what I'm presenting here, I'd be happy to clarify.
Can you clarify? I'm not really getting that chart. What is the chart saying?
Right. So this study was done by placing scalp recording electrodes on the head and measuring millisecond by millisecond changes, so 1,000 measures per second of electrical fields on the scalp that are generated by, remember back when I showed you that single cell and the neuron, and finally it got to the point of firing a signal out? Well, we have layered structures in our brains, such as cortex, where we have many neurons aligned, parallel to each other, so that when there's a lot of activity in an area, there's a lot of signals passing through these axonal cables, the axons, the outputs of these cells, in a parallel direction. And when that happens, it's a strong enough effect on the electromagnetic field that it can be detected far away, all the way outside the skull and on the top of the scalp. So that's what EEG is. It's a measure of brain electrical activity, and all the murmurings that are happening in a single neuron this and a single neuron that don't show up. It's only when large groups of neurons firing together that are happen to be anatomically located in a parallel fashion that produce signals strong enough to impact what's measured on the scalp. And so looking at the signals coming in an electrode placed on the right side of the head, and looking at the timing of those oscillations in the field compared to an electrode on the left side of the head, when those are more in sync with each other, and I just showed a picture that tried to demonstrate that graphically, there's mathematical analysis, data analysis, that renders a statistic of the percent coherence. And this is not 100% coherence. This is a sort of a maximum of less than 20% coherence between the activity in this gamma band of power of at 25 to 42 hertz. So it's pretty technical. And so, you know, the fact you're like, well, wait, I don't understand all of that makes a lot of sense. So I've tried to provide a little bit more detail, which of course itself has the potential to be confusing or disorienting. But suffice it to say that these data do clearly show a difference between when the participant is practicing metta, loving kindness meditation, and when they're not. And that difference is greater electrical coherence between activity of neurons on the left and the right side of the brain.
When you say coherence, I'm just thinking in terms of the signals itself. They are, I guess, actually they're random units. Or it can be analyzed with a Fourier transform. There are components of it. So when you say coherence, would it mean in phase of different components, frequencies?
It means if it were 100% coherent, the phase would be in constant relation between the in these frequency ranges in the left and the right side of the head. And so there can be slippage. Some things can slow down, so others can speed up. And is there any relation at all? If they were just randomly related to each other, there'd be 0% coherence. And so the fact that it's higher means that the, we didn't talk about this today, but the pathways that connect these different circuits are putting them in communication with each other so that they're acting in greater harmony physiologically with each other.
When you speak about coherence, then you're really talking, as deep as I hear it, and you use the word relationship. It's not about a what, it's about a pattern that connects, that expands.
Yes.
Smoothly.
Yeah, it's different parts of the brain, not just each beavering away on its own task, but actually doing what it does while being in relation to other parts of the brain doing their thing. Yes.
So if there's greater coherence physiologically, is it your assumption then that there's greater coherence maybe emotionally or psychospiritually, or how are you?
Yeah, subjectively, that's my bet. I think that's a likely possibility for which scant data exist, though these data are consistent with that thinking.
We go up to a couple minutes. What's it like through the course of an hour?
Great question. And I don't know. What happens in research is you study some small number of people who are appear quite adept at what it is you're trying to look at. And if you find a significant effect, such as was found in this study, then that sets the stage for further investigation. It's very difficult to attract funding for research that doesn't have a good bet of paying off. And so often an early study such as this will provide a tantalizing finding, which then raises so many further questions that are important to address and that are likely to be addressed in coming years, though it does take time. So pushing on. So this is exactly the question that came up earlier, that we have our own, what it's like to be on the inside of a living nervous system, I think, among other things, and what it's like to have awareness dawn in a way that it is not about ego or self-identification. It's beyond that. And indeed, only some of the parts of the brain seem to be involved in self-identification and ego function. So there are other parts of the brain that don't take themselves so seriously in that way. So this is just an idea of looking at that self-identification on a scale. So these aren't data. This is just sort of a theory I'm offering, that as we grow older, into adulthood, our ego strength increases. And for over 100 years, Western psychology has thought that's the course of human development. But I think that's only half the story. With a contemplative path, I think what often happens is the degree to which we take ourselves seriously declines on a good day, and we're not such the egomaniac all the time. And so I think there's a future for contemplative psychological science to investigate this larger path of human development. And here's the other data slide that we were hoping to get to. So with 20 participants, insight meditation practitioners, compared to normal control subjects, looking for differences in their brain, not brain function this time, but brain structure. The cortex is a thin sheet that is rather large and, in order to fit in our skull, is wrinkled up. So there are convexities and concavities, gyri and sulci, that if we were to mathematically blow up like a beach ball, we then get an image like this that shows this computationally inflated brain, allowing us to see areas in the dark that otherwise would be in the concavities and hidden from view if we were just to look at the surface. So if it looks a little funny as a brain, that's why. It turns out that since we do know something about many parts of the brain and what kind of experience they're involved in, I want to introduce you to the insula. Insular cortex, in both left and right sides, is involved in both bodily sensation and emotional sensation. So feelings of all kinds involve and rely on processing in the insula. Insight meditation, and these are long-time practitioners, involves attending to all of that and sustaining attention during meditation to that internal milieu. And it turns out that years of attending to those aspects of human experience have a result that changes the anatomy of the brain. In particular, the insula, that cortical sheet, measurably thickens. We don't yet know why, in terms of are the neurons growing bigger? are there more neurons? Are there more glia or other types of brain cells in that tissue? Perhaps after a brain autopsy or two, those questions could be answered. But at this point, all we know is that through structural imaging, using magnetic resonance imagery, if you look at a group of meditators compared to non-meditators, that part of the brain has grown. The inference being grown by virtue of the meditation practice of, for hours and hours and hours and hours, attending to certain aspects of our experience, bodily and emotional feelings. So that reinforces what we had learned earlier, which is meditation in these cases, and perhaps contemplative practice more broadly, have not just state effects, changing what it's like to have experience when you're involved in the practice or when you're not, but also more trait effects, where for long-time practitioners, it makes a difference. And not just in that person's experience or how they manifest in the world, but also how their brain is structured and how the brain functions. So I could leave it there in order to invite further discussion.
It's like everybody's doing the same thing, and it's easier to control the variables. And then the question I have is, does that mean that because insight meditation is a particular technique, meta meditation is a particular technique, that people are developing particular skills that are more narrow, and that you're going to see an effect of this kind of meditation or that kind or that kind of that kind? You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And so... so then, is it possible to generalize that or not? I mean, then do you say, well, insight meditation produces that kind of effect, and so
you've just put your finger on one of the major problems in the current literature on published studies of meditation, which is rather than being a coherently organized field of study, it's more of an archipelago. A series of islands of different studies where one research group had access to a certain population of meditators and asked a certain question from a particular point of view using their own methods. And so there's little opportunity for systematic comparison and integration of distinct studies. For that reason, in the Consciousness Laboratory at Naropa University, we have inaugurated a battery of assessment tools that are developed to work with any and all styles of meditation so that we and other researchers can use these instruments to find out and quantify parameters of training, practice, and experience of people engaged in any and all types of contemplative practice. And that work is ongoing, but it seeks to address this lack of methodology that allows for the development of an integrated scientific field of inquiry. So that's a problem, yes.
In this test, if you were to continue this and you were to find over a longer period of time that larger groups of selected people were found to have an increase in cohesiveness in their brain activity, what are the implications of that? Or what is it that, because I guess I can understand what you're testing for, but then I'm wondering beyond that, where are you hoping to maybe take that?
Right. What difference does it make when we see something in a brain? To a practitioner, it may make very little difference. Unless that practitioner were to suffer brain damage, which does happen from time to time, and if an understanding of the cellular involvement in contemplative technique and experience could help therapeutically address problems that arise due to brain damage. Certainly there are speech and language pathologists and therapists who work with people who have brain damage of a certain kind, so too with motor control, of controlling movements of the body. Who knows? You know, maybe there could be neuropsychological, spiritual counselors who, based on knowledge derived from studies such as these, might be able to help a person in that difficult circumstance. That's wild speculation, but there is that possibility. However, in the world we live in today, where in this culture, in this continent, I would venture to bet there might be more people who give credence to science than give credence to their own spiritual experience. And to the extent that there is such scientism, the worshiping of science as a venue for truth, then any scientific study that gains even a glimmer of understanding of human spirituality and the occurrence of spiritual experience and any antecedent conditions that might facilitate that and so on is an understanding that has a good chance of being disseminated and taken in by people who could thereby benefit.
I think you initiated the presentation with brain cells. And I'm assuming that doesn't mean that the communications are only the brain cells are capable of. The Eastern tradition, you know, Deepak Chopra, I think they talk of every cell has intelligence and therefore they can communicate too. So would I say that, you know, let's say in an experience of while meditating or experience of oneness or thoughtless, like saints do, it's the involvement of all the living cells of the body.
So the question is, which cells are involved? Does it go beyond the nervous system? I'm reminded of the fact that I sort of keep coming back to, it's very helpful, that the body of scientific knowledge is incomplete and inaccurate. So what little we do know is that brain cells, in particular neurons, do seem to have a seat at the table for involvement in conscious experience. And indeed, they're extremely well suited because they're connected. They get 10,000 inputs and 10,000 outputs. They're highly connected. And they have the means by which, that we understand already, to communicate with each other very quickly, many times a second. So are other cells involved in communicating with neurons or with each other? I wouldn't be at all surprised. But the chemical means that they have to communicate with only nearby cells would not put them in as close communication or rapid communication as our neurons. And perhaps other means other than chemical are available to them. And if so, great. I hope that science can grow to encompass that fact of nature, if that turns out to be the case. There are, in addition to neurons, cells called glia. Glial cells, G-L-I-A, they used to be thought of just as support cells in the brain, in keeping neurons healthy. But there's increasing evidence that they're actually themselves involved in communication, intercellular communication, with a higher time constant. It takes longer. They're not as rapid communicators as our neurons. So that's already a growing of brain science in the direction that you're speaking to. And how far that goes, I have no idea.
I think there is a minute ago we're kind of getting towards like what are the benefits of some of this understanding. Do you find that there is there research on therapeutic connections to meditation and such?
Yeah.
And do you find it coherent with the neuroscience and this sort of thing?
Right. So there are many researchers now looking at primarily physical health effects of meditation. And whether with cancer patients or heart patients or other groups, there is demonstrated effects both from meditation as well as prayer and other spiritual and religious engagement. That it begins to reveal the strong mind-body, heart-body connection between spiritual life and physical health. And that is already becoming relatively well-established as a field of active research. In fact, even the federal government has stepped up to the plate there through NCAM, part of the National Institutes of Health. They're in Bethesda, Maryland. There's the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine that, in addition to looking at St. John's wort and acupuncture and many other healing modalities, also is funding research on meditation for physical health applications. As a psychologist and as a meditator, I'm wanting to focus my efforts as a researcher on the more psychological and spiritual and contemplative developmental aspects of meditation, because most scientific researchers have not taken that one on. And it's, I think, politically a bit more precarious to do so. And I think has the potential of being of benefit.
I'm reminded of one of Ken Wilber's books, and he speaks about the practitioner linking their practice to scientific evidence and cautioning that the scientific community moves much faster and evolves much quicker. And one day, science may validate your practice, and one day it may not. And would that mean that your practice is no longer useful? Do you have a sense of that, too, as you being a practitioner and scientifically trying to find out what's working and what's not?
So, a lot hinges on where we find truth, what we take as given. And I guess I'm something of a radical subjectivist in that I see all knowledge as entering through my lived experience, my subjective experience. And so that's what I feel most comfortable taking as given. And this view that I'm told of pertaining to an objective world and objective truth is something that feels a little slippery to me. I don't know how to make direct contact with that. So the rock that some people find in scientific explanation feels inadequate to me. So I agree that counting on some external confirmation to be necessary for us to recognize something as true is a giving over of authority that is not needed, that it's optional, that just as psychology sometimes suffers from physics envy, where we think, oh, you know, physics is a hard science and it's kind of really a science, and psychology, oh, it wants to be a science too. And, you know, consciousness is mysterious and energetic and amazing, and subatomic physics is mysterious and complex in ways, and you know, the interdependence that we experience as living beings with the rest of our lived world seems to parallel a kind of physical interdependence at the subatomic level, and therefore they must be the same, that our lived interdependent co-arising must be the same as what's happening at the atomic level. That makes me nervous. Because physics, more than any other field that I know of in science, goes through radical changes. So if someday the physics story changes, does that then disrupt the lived truth of our being connected with each other? I say no. I say let us assert the truth of our experience. Let our field of understanding stand on its own. And any or all parts of science may or may not agree, and it's a very interesting dialogue and may spur us to reflect on matters that we wouldn't otherwise think about. But that placing our faith in that support seems unwise.
Thank you. Have there been any experiments done or observations done using the kind of instrumentality that you've been using with this? Some of the things done with other groups who practice types of intense concentration in terms of formless ideation with a single intention, such as a chess master or a mathematician working out an equation.
Right. In general, in the field of skill acquisition, there's a finding that comes up again and again and hasn't yet been shown to be the case in meditation, but it could well be, that it takes about 10,000 hours of practice to get really good at something. Sorry if that's bad news. And when you look at someone who's played the violin for 10,000 hours, and you look at their brain, you can see changes in their brain akin to differences like this, that there is functional specialization that happens. And so the functional brain imaging studies have not yet pursued all domains of skill acquisition. And I haven't seen a study on chess players, though there could well be. It's really a blossoming literature at this point. But there is that general finding.
For the violin player, part of the brain changes, if I understand it correctly, have to do with all the coordination, eye, hand, etc., right? So you're working the neural pathways that are exercised in the performance of whatever instrument you're using. Mathematicians working on an equation, most of that, or a lot of that, just goes on in the interior up here. And same with chess masters, once you get used to moving the pieces, which is pretty low level, the rest of it goes on up here. And from just some of the descriptions of some of the great chess masters, I mean, you're not thinking images.
Yeah, so I would agree with your intuition and bet that if you take chess masters who have put in more than 10,000 hours into their game, you could find structural and or functional differences in their brain. I think that's a good bet. We know from a brain autopsy of Einstein's brain that his parietal cortex was larger than normal. And I don't know if it started out that way before he went down his path of contemplative physics, or whether it was in part cultivated by his efforts.
I have another question. Recent publication called The Dalai Lama at MIT, a large part of it was seemed to be devoted to an effort by the Buddhists involved to legitimize introspection as a, at least for a scientifically valid form of analysis of consciousness and conscious functions. And do you have any comments about
Yeah. It's true that each of us has our own unique vantage point most directly into our own experience that other people may not share. And I like to point that out to students because it actually puts an onus on each of us to pay attention to what happens in our experience and to appreciate it, because nobody else has that same experience of the world, as do you. The act of introspecting, of looking within, of noticing what's unfolding in your experience as it happens, is one source of data. As a scientist, I'm skeptical of any particular source of data, including introspection. I look for taking different angles on an issue and looking for different sources of data that adopt different methods and see whether similar patterns are found by taking a look at an issue from different angles. If it looks similarly from the inside as from the outside, then you begin to find a degree of convergence between these different approaches that is mutually reinforcing and supports a particular interpretation. Sometimes that happens. Sometimes there's a disparity between different views, and it's more complex, and there isn't agreement, and at that point, you become hesitant as a scientist to interpret the results in a particular way that is not supported by all the data. So I think in this 21st century, introspection has a long way to go to be widely accepted in scientific investigation as fully as it could be. But when you go to a doctor's office and they ask you, does this hurt? You are introspecting and providing a verbal report in response. And in the last few years, they've actually adopted a method that's been developed for decades in psychological science of using a rating scale up to 10. Is this an 8 for you or just a 5? And it's surprising the degree to which that information is useful. Because even if people have different points, maybe my 8 is your 10, nonetheless, there can be an internal consistency to those quantified observations on experience. If I come in a few times over the years and it's been a 5 and a 3 and a 6 and now it's a 9, wow, well, this is perhaps a stronger pain than I've reported before and is worth noting in that way. So introspection provides a unique source of data and is best held skeptically and perhaps acquired in skillful ways that have been developed in previous psychological research. And, yes?
I was struck by one of your charts where you were talking about early on about the different parts of the brain and having specific functions like sight, and then there's one with fear. And then you added hope. I've always felt hope rather sort of like a delusion, you know? That, and I didn't realize it was a part of my brain that actually functions in a hopeful way. Have you found that to be the case? Is there actual physical evidence of hope?
Actually, of all those parts of that graphic, it's the hope that was the most speculative on my part. I often think of hope and fear as complementary to each other. And there is a part of the brain called the amygdala, this almond-shaped area that is known in various ways to be involved in fear. And there are parts of frontal cortex that are involved in planning and strategizing, and I don't have clear evidence that they're involved in hope. So that was an imputation on my part. Yes.
Okay, just a comment on that. Since I'm an investor, I play markets. So when you say hope is the opposite of fear, in markets, it's greed and fear. I don't know if it makes sense. So, maybe hope and greed are related. I don't know. But at the same time, we also think in terms of our gut feeling or our love and emotion in our heart. So, all these parts, I mean, they still, traditions think that they also, they can think, or the thought processes are involved in other organs, not just only in the brain.
The nervous system is not limited to the brain and spinal cord. There's a peripheral nervous system suffusing our body with sensitivity and modulation or control, so that when you attend to a hand, that actually increases blood flow and can increase the warmth. So the instruction to feel warmth in a particular area can actually change temperature in tissue by virtue of vasodilation. So the influence, the interconnection between the nervous system and the rest of the body is quite intimate. Any block of tissue other than hair or fingernail that you open up, you'll find nerve endings. So when we talk about cellular memory, when we talk about muscle memory, that a touch here might really bring to your lived experience a memory that you hadn't had in a while. I don't have to step out of the nervous system in order to explain how that happens, because the connections between neurons is extensive and pervades our body. And it could be that there's more involved in the nervous system. I don't know. All I have clear evidence for so far is the nervous system. So it seems to be at least that, and perhaps more.
This gentleman, Dr. I think I talked to you about Professor Amit Goswami. I think he's relating some of the stuff is beyond. It's in quantum realm.
I'd be interested to see any data that demonstrates that we need to go beyond the electrochemical communication between neurons in the nervous system to account for human experience. So far, I have not seen those data. I'm not saying they don't exist.
A question about the uniqueness of meditation, that is, to your knowledge, your introspective experience as also as a scientist, are there any other modes of mental activity that would result in a similar level of coherence that was exhibited in the graphic representation?
I wouldn't be at all surprised if activities, whether spontaneous or intentional, other than meditation per se, have similar effects. In our own research, we operationalized meditation by asking someone, so have you ever meditated? And if the person says no, then they're off the hook. But if they say yes, or I'm not sure, I've done this, does that count as meditation? Then we collect data from them. So we don't have a clear delineation of what is so far from meditation, it's not a contemplative practice. Rather, we're gathering data from anyone who appears to be in the neighborhood, and then in some time, perhaps based on those data, we'll be able to make such delineations as, oh, we recognize these distinct forms of meditation, and we recognize these as not being meditation. But so far as a field, many people are willing to venture a definition and say, here's what we think meditation is. And in many instances, it seems to be coming from their head. Like, there's that idea, okay. But I'm really more of an empirical scientist than a theoretical scientist. And I, on a good day, want to collect a lot of data and then listen to those data and have them inform our thinking. So whether it's watching the sunset or being in nature or being in church or being with family, whatever it is, if we have experience, then that has its own integrity. And I'm interested, of course, in gathering data about such experience.
I was actually thinking also of mountain climbing. And some people that I know that do it professionally, they speak of similar coherence or open awareness resulting from a strenuous physical effort involved in climbing.
Yes. Why not?
In that book I mentioned, Dalai Lama at MIT, there's a large section of the book devoted to an argument that neuroscience should take the kind of analysis of consciousness found in the Abhidharma literature seriously. When you look at the Abhidharma on this, it splits up every act of consciousness into so many, many different instances. Each of those has many instances. It's just rather mind-boggling.
That's one benefit of the Abhidharma. It stops your mind. Yeah.
But they're essentially making a plea that the Abhidharma analysis of consciousness be taken seriously as an area of research. Mm-hmm.
I think any and all approaches are worth taking, and I hope that that approach is pursued diligently by taking ancient and wise characterization of mental phenomena as a theory to generate hypotheses to be tested. In our own research, we take a different approach, which is in an exploratory phase of gathering relevant data and only grudgingly interpreting those to the point of formulating theories and psychological models. So these approaches are complementary and could end up converging or not.
There's a wonderful piece of Admiral Byrd's diary when he talks about going out when he was in Antarctica, 80 degrees of frost in the morning, and he just writes about what he experiences, but what he came to was a profound sense of harmony in the cosmos. And I think that's what I heard you getting at a few questions back. It's a beautiful piece. But harmony is the word that came. It was all blending.
We're in such great need, many of us individually and all of us collectively, for more harmony. It really brings gatherings such as this to a poignant point. This is not mere intellectual curiosity, whatever degree that may be here as well. It's not just abstract academic involvement. It's using those perspectives and bringing those intellectual capacities to bear on personal work that is hard to imagine how it's not necessary for planetary healing. Louise.
The harmony that we were just talking about, is that another word for maybe the coherence in the two sides of the brain?
I like the idea that the objectively observed physiological measure of coherence may correspond with, from an internal living, breathing perspective, a sense of harmony.
Yeah.
That makes sense to me.
I had another question.
Wouldn't you add to harmony a degree of order, like opposite to noise information? Information theory there.
Sure. Certainly increasing coherence is corresponding to a measure of increasing structure and information. Yes. From that, the mathematics, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, for many years we hear about biofeedback, and maybe that's a type of neuroscience. I don't know. I've never experienced it, but I was always interested in it because it seemed like it showed you, okay, yes, if I do this, whatever that may be inside, then that produces, let's say, a slower brain wave that helps me relax. If I can see what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I was looking at this... the coherence study with the meditators. Is that a similar thing? I mean, the coherence, is that like these brain waves, alpha or whatever? Or is the coherence equal to relaxation?
Right. Typically, it's increase in alpha generated toward the back of the head between 8 and 12 cycles per second that is the primary marker for relaxation. And so this is in a different frequency band, and rather than just looking at how much energy there is at this frequency, rather it's whatever energy there is, how much in sync are different parts of the brain. So it's a rather distinct aspect of physiological activity of the nervous system and may thereby correspond to a different aspect of our lived experience, that rather than just relaxation, it might correspond to something like clarity or shared awareness, though that remains to be determined. You actually need independent measures of clarity or shared awareness in order to make such determinations. And indeed, that's part of our work, is we are developing methods we and other researchers can use to assess authenticity, compassion, and other contemplative parameters.
It's kind of a two-part question. One is about something you said yesterday. I think it comes up further along in the presentation about the participants collaborating and understanding the data. And you're looking at the data, so I'd like to know a little bit more about that, because it's curious to me. And the second question is, I just lost the second question.
Right. So there is a field of research or a methodological approach called action research, where, and we did not develop that. It's had a lifetime of the last 8 to 10 years or so. And in action research, that's the approach, is to elevate the role played by participants in research to that of a collaborator as well, so that you really benefit from the totality of their insight and understanding and experience. And we are only now laying the ground in preparation for starting some of our studies in this program of research to take that approach. We've not yet embarked on it ourselves. However, some of the studies of, like, the monk in the lab and so on, Matthew Ricard is a participant who has been consulted with regard to the design of studies that he has participated in. And so that is an example of researchers seeking to benefit in the design of their research by the understanding provided by an adept participant.
Okay, I'll stop you. I was thinking about it when we were talking about Einstein, and you know, it's the correlation doesn't imply causation thing.
Yes.
You don't know whether he was already right. So now, and of course, now I'm thinking about college students who are just starting on this path of yoga and meditation, and it won't it be great in a few years when there's a baseline so that we can study people before they start, teach them techniques. Study later and see, you know.
So you're pointing to the value of longitudinal research, where you follow the same cohort of individuals over years, and that requires significant resources and determination to pull off. And again, at Naropa, we're certainly laying the ground to conduct such longitudinal work ourselves. In fact, we've already collected data some years ago now, and we have the opportunity to follow up with some of those individuals after a span of 5 years.
Great. Yeah, before we finish today, I just wanted to point out that in this brochure of the Tehard Religion and Science Activities for this year, we're only halfway through with Peter's lecture yesterday and today. There's a week on Thursday, Vidhi Raman will be here, a physicist, talking about Hindu perspective and the role of consciousness in the universe on March 15th on the Goswami, and then on April 10th, Jeffrey Swartz on cosmology. All these are free and open to the public. Tell your friends, take more brochures. Also, I think there's some literature here from Naropa as well.
Oh, great.
Yeah, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the upcoming Hindu Catholic dialogue is going to be available to you on March 17th. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.